I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. Look, I do not like taking care of my lawn. I abuse my hose. I drag it all over the asphalt driveway. I tug it this way. I tug it that way. But the Pocket Hose Ballistic handles it all. This hose has changed my landscaping life. It's the toughest pocket hose ever built, reinforced with liquid crystal polymer used in bulletproof vests, something I know a little bit about. It's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store, and when you want to use it, you turn the water on, it grows, and then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. Pretty self-explanatory. It also comes with the pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows, and the water flows. And listen, I'm sure there are some of you saying, Derek, it's just a hose. But the pocket hose carries over 100 patents worldwide. So this isn't your typical hose. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On September 13th, 1991, 36-year-old Tom Roche dropped his longtime girlfriend off at work in Burbank, California. He told her he was heading home to work on his motorcycle and he had plans to meet her for lunch later that day, but Tom never showed up. Days later, Tom's girlfriend received a disturbing letter from someone claiming to have killed him. The writer included Tom's personal belongings and described luring him to a meeting before killing him. But more than 34 years later, his case remains unsolved, leaving everyone with the same question. What happened to Tom Roche? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And before I get into my little pre-briefing about the case, which I always do, I just want to send a quick thank you to each and every one of you. I had the opportunity to look at some of the ratings and reviews and also the analytics on both the YouTube channels and on the audio downloads, and it's been absolutely incredible, beyond anything I ever expected when we started this. And I tell people all the time that I'm so proud of what we're building over here. I know it sounds redundant, but I also really appreciate that you guys take the time to spread what we're doing, hype up the episodes, leave a rating, leave a review. It might not seem like much, it only takes a couple seconds, but you don't understand the impact that it has. There's so many shows out there, and the market, if you will, and I got that in air quotes, is so saturated, it's really hard, even if you have an existing audience, to break through that and have an impact. And I would love to see shows like Detective Perspective and other ones, it doesn't just have to be mine, but shows that are using their platforms to highlight these cases, especially the ones that most people haven't heard of. You guys really can control the narrative and decide who gets the most attention, who gets the most engagement. And I'm so thankful that you've chosen Detective Perspective to be one of the shows. I wouldn't be here without you guys, so thank you very much. I know I say it a lot, and maybe some of you are sick of it, but the reality is You have so many options to choose from, and it means a lot to me that you take the time to be with me every week. Okay, now transitioning to why we're really here and what's actually important, Tom Roche. This is a case that was interesting to me because Tom's originally from Rhode Island, and then he moved out to Burbank. Also, we're going to talk about his longtime girlfriend. She's actually from Rhode Island as well. And when I was doing some of the research for this case, I noticed that she actually moved back to Rhode Island after this all transpired. And I was going to reach out to her to see maybe if I could speak to her a little bit because she's so close, maybe grab a cup of coffee. But unfortunately, and I'm going to talk about this again in the episode, she passed away. And yet I don't know what it is, just having them be locals and hearing about some of the places that they grew up, you can't help but have that personal connection to it because it allows you to relate to them just a little bit more, which is why we always start off talking about the victim and who they were before this tragedy struck, because I think it does it for you guys as well, where instead of it just being a name or a quote unquote character, you find similarities or commonalities in their story as well. And it makes you more invested in the outcome. And I think it also incentivizes people to continue to spread the message about their story, and hopefully we get some results from it. So with Tom's case, this is one that I strongly believe that if it had happened in 2026, I wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. It would already be solved. And a little bit of extra that we have tonight that's really cool, and I really appreciated Shannon doing this. She went out to the actual area where Tom lived, and she took it upon herself without me even asking to go film some B-roll by herself, some actual footage of Tom's apartment area, the complex, as it sits right now. And for me, it was just critical to see that before recording and to get a true perspective of what that area looked like. When you see it later in this episode, you're going to feel the same way as me, where with all the cameras and all the cell phones and also all the apartments that are in that area, there's no doubt that if it happened tomorrow, we would have not only the suspect's identity, but also their vehicle. So it's unfortunate, based on the limitations of that time, that I'm having to cover this case now. But in some circumstances, we're able to take these older cases and apply the new science and technology that we have available today. So we're going to talk about the whole case. We have a lot to cover. Let's get into it. Thomas Richard Roche, who went by Tom, was born November 17, 1954, in Boston, Massachusetts, to parents Thomas and Barbara. He grew up in Warren, Rhode Island, and Pittsfield, Massachusetts, alongside his sisters and one brother. After graduating high school in 1973, Tom joined the Navy for a short period of time, but as soon as he could, he returned home to Rhode Island and began working in a metal shop. Around that same time, he started dating a woman named Barbara. According to the Los Angeles Times, the two had grown up together while Tom was living in Rhode Island. Their relationship quickly became serious, and although they never married, they built a life together and were committed to one another. Barbara described Tom as her whole life. The two shared many interests, but one passion stood above the rest: motorcycles. Much of their free time was spent riding, and Tom was especially proud of his Harley. According to those close to him, his motorcycle was his most prized possession. By 1988, Tom was in his early 30s and struggling with arthritis in his knee. The harsh Rhode Island winters had become difficult on him, and he and Barbara decided it was time for a change. So, looking for warmer weather, the couple relocated to Burbank, California. And I can confirm, as a fellow Rhode Islander, that although I love living here, I love the different seasonal changes that we have, there are some years, especially this last winter, where it's extremely difficult. And if you are someone who had arthritis, this is not the type of conditions you would want to be in. And that's why a lot of Rhode Islanders, especially people who are retired, they go down to Florida for the winter months and then come up during the summer. And what a luxury to have. I hope one day I'm in that position. Once settled, Tom continued working in a metal shop where he was a supervisor, and Barbara found work at a blueprint company, and the move turned out to be exactly what they had hoped for. The couple quickly fell in love with California and the freedom it gave them to ride motorcycles year-round. They joined a local motorcycle club and often spent weekends traveling across the state. By all accounts, they had built a life they truly enjoyed. By 1991, Tom was 36 years old and Barbara was 32. They had been together for more than 15 years and were looking forward to the future. That September, Tom was offered a well-paying management position with a company that worked on aircraft parts. He accepted the job and left his supervisor role at the machine shop. He was scheduled to begin his new position on Monday, September 16th, but everything changed 3 days later. On Friday, September 13th, Tom drove Barbara to work. Before dropping her off, he told her he planned to head home and install a battery on his motorcycle. The two made plans to meet for lunch later that day, but Tom never showed up, and he never called to explain why. And at first, Barbara was concerned, but she wasn't panicking yet. She wondered if maybe he had gotten caught up with something related to his job, possibly paperwork or something like that, and he just didn't have time to check in. Still, something about the situation did not sit right with her. Barbara was certain Tom would have called if he was running late or unable to meet up with her like he had done in the past. She did not believe that he would have left her waiting without any explanation. However, even with these feelings in the back of her mind, Barbara tried to continue with her day. But when she arrived home to their apartment on Rogers Street at approximately 5:30 p.m., things immediately felt off. Tom's motorcycle and vehicle were both there, and the front door was unlocked. According to Barbara, that alone was unusual because Tom kept the front door locked at all times, even when he was home. So she searched the apartment, but Tom was nowhere to be found. There were no signs of a struggle, and nothing appeared to be disturbed. Still, a few details did stand out to her. First off, the newspaper sat unopened on the table. Now, that may not sound significant to you or even to me, but Barbara knew Tom's routine, and what she knew is that every single morning, without fail, he would read the sports section. Then there was the motorcycle battery sitting on the counter, the same battery Tom had said he had planned to install that morning. Both of these items told Barbara that Tom hadn't been able to go about his morning like he had planned to. But Barbara went to check the answering machine to see if there was anything there, but it had been unplugged. This was not completely unusual for their house because that was something Tom did when he planned to stay home. However, when he left the house, he would always plug it back in if he knew he wasn't going to be around. Nothing she found in the house made any sense. Barbara waited throughout the evening, hoping that Tom would come home or at least call, but he never did. The following morning, Barbara reported Tom missing to the Burbank Police Department. She explained that disappearing without warning was completely out of character for him. If Tom was having problems or wanted to leave, he would have told her. She also made one thing very clear. Tom would have never willingly left his Harley behind. Barbara said, quote, "It was his baby. He would never leave it. There is no way that he left on his own." The Burbank Police Department took the report and interviewed Tom and Barbara's neighbors, but no one had seen or heard from him since that morning. At this point, I think I'm going to show you some footage, and this is really cool because without doxing her, my editor, Shannon, who I've mentioned many times on this channel, is in the California area, I'll just say that, and she took it upon herself to go out and video record the apartment complex area where Tom lived to give me a better understanding of what we were dealing with. There are some recreations that have been done that are on YouTube and you can go check those out, but there's nothing like seeing the actual crime scene. There's no substitute. So I don't know if Shannon is going to splice this video throughout this episode or if we're going to play it now, but I'm going to have her cue up just some of it here so you can get an idea of what the area looked like. And I will tell you that you wouldn't think this was all there back when this occurred, but from what we gathered, these buildings, at least most of them, have been there since the 1960s. So yes, this occurred in 1991. It might have looked a little different, but it appears that the overall structures and layout of the complex was there when this crime occurred. So let's play a little bit of that footage now.
The main entrance. I'm trying not to stop too much because I don't want to look like I'm recording someone's house. And as you can see, for the area, they're all complexes are all right up against each other. So like here's the rest of the street.
So there it is. And again, shout out to Shannon. This is, again, what I love about you guys and love about our team. Everybody from Shannon to Haley to the community that gets engaged in the comments. We're all in it for the same thing. And it's this isn't just a job. This is something that we're truly passionate about. And again, I just have to give a shout out to Shannon because I didn't even suggest to her like, hey, it'd be cool if we had video from Tom's neighborhood. Nope. She literally just hit me up and was like, I'm driving by there. And then all of a sudden in my Google Drive, I got this awesome video to watch. And it's just, it's really cool to be surrounded by people who share the same passions as you. And she happens to be extremely talented at editing as well. So she makes me look good every week. So shout out to you, Shannon. Okay, so at this point, police were not sure what happened to Tom. And since there were no signs of foul play, they believed he would likely return home. So they, quote, held back the report and they waited a few days before entering it into the system. I don't know exactly what this entails. That's why I'm kind of quoting it here. My reading between the lines is that they probably didn't do like a full investigation at this point. They filed it, they documented it, and they probably had it on standby to see if he returned. This isn't completely uncommon. What I would like to hear, and maybe this occurred and we just don't know, is that there was a preliminary investigation. Maybe it wasn't something as intense as it would be for a missing juvenile, but something where they scoured the neighborhood or made some calls, went by locations that he frequented, or spoke with friends, colleagues, family members, whatever you can gather initially just to say, hey, we're trying to get a hold of you. If you're around, give us a call back. If they just threw this file on the desk and didn't touch it for a couple days, that's unacceptable. And I've said it to you guys over the last couple years we've been doing this. When the report isn't like filed, and I'm doing air quotes for people on audio, that can look bad. But if I were to learn that there was this, you know, investigation going on behind the scenes, I'm cool with that. But as we always say, if it's not in the report, it didn't happen, and it allows for speculation and criticism by not only their colleagues, but by people like me. And so that's why we're covering it here. And do I think that them responding immediately in this case would have made a difference? When you hear the rest of the details, probably not. But who am I to say for certain? Things happen all the time that I don't expect. So I'd rather proceed with caution, file the report, go guns blazing, and be overcautious than not do enough. So I don't know exactly what they did. I obviously know what the outcome is going to be here. You don't yet, but I want your opinions. After you hear everything, there's a couple things that we can focus in on. This may be one of them. Feel free to comment down below or even leave a rating on Apple or Spotify, and you can leave your comment there. I read them all. And let me know if you think that this right here was a critical mistake in the case that could have prevented what we're going to talk about from happening. So while law enforcement was holding this report back, Barbara did everything she could to try to find Tom. She created a missing person flyer featuring multiple photos of Tom along with his description. Tom was 6'2" tall, weighed approximately 210 pounds, and had both a biking tattoo and a wizard tattoo. He also wore a single earring. Barbara posted flyers at places that Tom often spent time and kept asking around to see if anyone had seen or heard from him, but unfortunately, no one had. After several days passed with no word, the police officially classified Tom as a missing person. But investigators still had no idea where he could be or what may have happened to him. As they looked further into Tom's background, they found nothing that raised concerns. He had no criminal record, and according to those close to him, he did not use drugs. They also looked into the motorcycle club that he and Barbara belonged to, but there was no indication that it was tied to anything criminal. It was made up of working professionals, including accountants and lawyers. This wasn't your typical motorcycle club that you may be thinking of when I say this. There's local motorcycle clubs all over the country. There's even motorcycle clubs that consist of police officers and firefighters. There's a lot of different local clubs out there that aren't like those outlaw clubs that you may be thinking of. So not your Sons of Anarchy TV show that we're talking about here. And so based on this background check that investigators conducted, they didn't seem to think that Tom was involved in anything illicit or suspicious. His family and friends said the same thing. They told investigators they couldn't think of anyone who would want to hurt him. But as we know from covering so many of these cases, just because someone hasn't publicly displayed any animosity or anger towards someone, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It could be a closeted resentment that they've purposely hidden from others. On the other hand, if we're to believe exactly what they're saying and they're right, that just further suggests that the person responsible for whatever happened to Tom may have been a stranger. So the investigation into Tom's disappearance continued, but for days, investigators had no leads. Then, on September 19th, 6 days after Tom vanished, an envelope arrived at their apartment. We're going to talk about it right after this break because it's chilling. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and the goal isn't just to talk about mental health, it's to actually take action and get people real support. But when you try to do that, it's still way harder than it should be. A lot of online therapy doesn't accept insurance at all, which means even during a month focused on mental health, you're stuck paying out of pocket or signing up for an expensive monthly subscription. Rula does things differently. They partner with over 120 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from a licensed professional at a price that actually makes sense. Because the whole point of Mental Health Awareness Month is making sure that people actually get help, not just think about it. And Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is actually helping you move forward. Mental Health Awareness Month is your reminder to finally take that step, and this is one of the easiest ways to actually follow through. No wait lists, no frustrating back and forth, appointments that can be available as soon as tomorrow. So go to Rula.com/detective to get started today. That's RULA.com/detective for quality therapy that's covered by insurance. All right, we're back, so let's talk about this envelope. First off, it was addressed, quote, to the family of Tom Roche. Now, inside were several of Tom's personal belongings, his driver's license, a credit card, and the earring he had been wearing the day he disappeared. It also included a typed 2-page letter. This letter was unsigned and had no return address. The full letter has never been released publicly, but portions of it have, so I'm going to read them for you now. The letter read in part, quote, "I am suffering a great deal of guilt right now about what I have done, and I feel it necessary to write about it for my own sake and yours. You don't know me, and hopefully you never will, but I am the one who killed Tom Roche. I cannot and will not go to jail. I could never handle it. I almost lost my mind. Never again." The writer went on to claim that he had served in Vietnam, stating, quote, "I loved Vietnam. In fact, those were the happiest days of my life. I felt such a rush whenever I had a confirmed kill that it was hard to switch it off when I came back to the States. For 18 long years, I have held this in check despite the nightmares and fantasies about killing. This Jeffrey Bemmer thing really got me, and I wondered if I could still do it." And I do want to note that the writer appeared to be referring to Jeffrey Dahmer, who had just been arrested a few months earlier in July of 1999, but he clearly got the last name wrong. I don't even think it was a spelling error. I think he truly thought Jeffrey Dahmer's last name was Bemmer. Clearly, he didn't do a lot of research, but I wanted to be as accurate as possible because so far in this letter, if it's true, if it's honest, and spoiler alert, I think most of it is, this person is telling us a lot of different things about him. And maybe he has referred to Jeffrey Dahmer as Jeffrey Bemmer to someone in the past. So by itself, that may seem insignificant, but in totality with everything else that he's talked about, it could end up being a smoking gun, right? If we found someone who identified a person who matched this description and happened to refer to Jeffrey Dahmer to their friends and family members as Jeffrey Bemmer, I think that would be really important because how many people out there were incorrectly identifying Jeffrey Dahmer and calling him Jeffrey Bemmer? Probably not many. But that wasn't the end of the letter because the writer continued, stating, quote, "I figured LA would be the best place for what I had in mind. I did not want just a random thing because you can get caught that way, so I set up a plan. The writer continued saying, quote, I met Tom at a strip joint in the valley and got to talking. They later arranged a meeting at which the writer planned to, quote, quickly and efficiently kill him. The letter continued, quote, he fell for it and we arranged to meet on Friday the 13th. I must assure you that it was neat and quick. I do not think he suffered at all. The writer ended the letter by stating, quote, I am very sorry for what I have done. I know that in time the guilt will leave me, so will your pain. I sent along some personal belongings of his just so that you won't think this is some kind of sick joke or anything. Tom's sister later told the media that the letter also mentioned that Tom's remains had been buried in the mountains around Los Angeles. Now, it's unclear if that's accurate or not because, as I mentioned, certain portions of the letter have never been released. After reading the letter, Barbara immediately contacted the police. Investigators examined both the letter and the envelope, hoping to find fingerprints, but from what we've learned, there were none. Now, there was a postmark showing when and where the letter had been mailed. However, as an investigative tactic, that information has never been released publicly. And I understand that at the time. I understand that 10 years later. I may even understand it 20 years later. But now we're over 30. And clearly, investigators have not been able to crack this one open. So based on what has been released publicly about the letter, and based on the postmark, and based on the other information we have, which we still have to get to, I would say now is the time. Now is the time for everything to come out. We need to see the entire letter. We need to see all the information about the postmark. We need to have everything to make an informed decision. Because you guys aren't going to solve it. It's going to take someone from the public to do it. And that's okay. It doesn't mean you're not good at your job. It just means, unfortunately, that in this case, the writer was better than you. And so we need to do what we can before it's too late to find this person. And I have a strong suspicion that based on everything that you have released, there may be somebody out there that can connect the dots and say, hey, you might want to look into this guy. And for all we know, it's already someone on their short list. At this point, I think we're in a scenario where it's all hands on deck. It's a last ditch effort. You got to reach out to the community. And the only way they can truly help you is if they have all the facts. And just to add a little bit more gas on that fire, investigators have shared publicly that they worked with the authorities in the city where the letter originated, but they were unable to identify the suspect. And that just is even more of a reason why they have to expand the scope. And that involves getting the community to help out. As far as the letter itself, investigators initially didn't really know what to make of it. They knew for sure that it was connected to Tom because it contained his personal belongings, but they weren't sure if it was based in truth or if it was meant to throw them off. They thought it was possible that the writer had actually killed Tom, like the letter claimed, or they thought it was also possible that Tom left willingly and maybe he wrote the letter himself to make people believe that something had happened to him. Either way, investigators couldn't be sure what was actually going on here or what the letter was designed to do, so they kept digging. My two cents here is I think the letter's legitimate. This person was not on anybody's radar, and yet they took it upon themselves to write this letter and mail it to Tom's home. I think this person was mentally disturbed, and I think a lot of what they talked about in the letter is probably spot on. This is someone who didn't have a lot to lose, had been dealing with this, whatever you want to call it, for many years, still at some point had some level of morality to let his family, Tom's family, know what had happened to him because they felt that that was the right thing to do. And I don't think anything in there was intended to throw law enforcement off. I don't think this person would have written a letter and potentially exposed themselves in order to try to make law enforcement go in the wrong direction. The better choice there would be do nothing at all. Don't raise any red flags. Don't submit any potential evidence that could be used against you later, right? This is a risk. It's an unnecessary risk. There's no need to send this letter. Stay in the shadows. You know, we talk about BTK in the past. We talked about it on Crime Weekly a lot. What ultimately did him in was his own hubris, sending in those letters, sending in the disk drive. That's what did him in. And so this person, I think they were truly doing it. And I'm not trying to say they're a good person, but they did it because they felt bad for Tom's family and friends, and they wanted to try and at least give them some closure. Again, not trying to paint this person as a good person, but I truly think that's what was going on here. And so I would believe the letter, and I hope that law enforcement did, because in our perspective, we're going to dissect what he said and try to develop a profile on who this person could be. And maybe there's someone out there who recognizes this description and finally makes a call, but we'll get there. Having said that, is it possible that I'm wrong? Of course it is. Is it possible that at this point in the story, this is some elaborate plan, hoax, if you will, designed by Tom because he no longer wished to be involved in his life and wanted to convince everyone that he was dead? Sure, he would be in possession of those personal belongings, right? He would know what to set up at home to make it look like something went wrong. So yeah, it's possible, but we're not done with the story yet. According to Unsolved Mysteries, investigators worked to piece together everything Tom had done before his disappearance. And the hope was that they would figure out whether he left willingly or if he had been murdered. Investigators learned that after dropping Barbara off at work, Tom stopped by the bank. At approximately 8:20 a.m., he made two deposits, including his paycheck. He did not withdraw any money, which investigators felt suggested he was not planning to leave town, and I would agree. The next confirmed sighting of Tom was back at the apartment complex. A neighbor told police that they saw Tom speaking with an unidentified male at approximately 9:30 a.m. According to the neighbor, the two men were standing near a pickup truck and appeared to be looking in the truck bed. The neighbor said that they were not arguing and nothing about the interaction stood out as unusual. It just looked like a normal conversation. Again, just to show you what we're talking about here, because I think it's important to really have an understanding of what this area looked like, let's play a little bit more of Shannon's video.
And then for context, this is the 5 freeway right here. That's what that wall is blocking. And this is the actual apartment building. Let me zoom out a bit more. There we go.
And so there's the apartment complex again. And as I mentioned earlier, if this case had happened today, I think you would all agree with me at this point. And if you're watching on YouTube, then you know what I'm referring to. If you're listening on audio, strongly recommend that you write down this timestamp and go check out this video, because this particular video will only be found here. And as I said at the top of the show, if this crime had occurred in 2026, more than likely we would have video of that interaction. Think about all the apartments around that area. There's going to be a camera there. Someone's going to have something pointing at that street, or there could be dash cams or whatever else you could have. I mean, think about all the ways we have found suspects at this point using the latest technology that is available to civilians. I'm not even talking about law enforcement technology. And then just one final note, because I think it's worth mentioning, Shannon pointed out that the highway is right there as well. Now, do I think this is something that was pre-planned by the offender? Probably not, because if we're to believe the letter in its entirety, they met Tom at a strip club and they wouldn't have known where he lived at that point. There was a plan to meet up the next day, and I'm assuming that Tom told him where to go. So it's relevant, but I don't think it contributes to the pre-plan that took place by this offender, unless they had maybe seen Tom before, followed him home, knew where he lived, and then after the fact befriended him at the strip club. Yeah, that's possible. And this would be a quick exit to get a hold of Tom and get on the highway and get out of that area as soon as possible. And unfortunately, this eyewitness account was the last time anyone reported seeing Tom. After that, he disappeared. He didn't get around to his morning plans, which included reading the sports page, replacing the motorcycle battery, or going to meet Barbara for lunch. And because Tom was last seen with an unidentified man, investigators considered the possibility that that man could also be the person who wrote the letter and potentially killed Tom. But as far as I can tell, they have never been able to figure out who that man was. And I know for a fact that's the case, because I too believe that whoever that man is, he is the person we're looking for. Now, before we continue, I do want to take a little detour, because it's not my job to decipher what's fact from fiction. I want to present everything I have to you guys, and we can all talk about this and we can all come to our own conclusions. So, although that was the last confirmed sighting of Tom in the apartment complex, investigators did speak to someone who claimed to have seen Tom after September 13th. An employee at a motorcycle parts store in Glendale, California, which is around 10 minutes from Burbank, told police that he had seen Tom come into the shop on Saturday, September 14th. According to this employee, whose name is Andy, he's actually in the TV series that covered Tom's disappearance, he said that when Tom came in, and this is someone who he knew, things felt a little bit off. He said that Tom was acting somewhat strange and did not joke around like he normally did, so the interaction stood out to him. Andy also told police that while Tom was in the store, Andy had to step into the warehouse for a second to grab some parts for a customer, and when he came back out, Tom was gone. And that was also out of character for Tom, because he always said bye. Andy went on to say that he never saw or heard from Tom again, and when investigators pressed him on the date, he was adamant that it happened on Saturday the 14th. Now, investigators would later say in the Unsolved Mysteries episode that they believed Andy did in fact see Tom. However, he was likely mistaken about the date. And I completely agree, unfortunately. When we get into the final part of this case, I think you will agree as well. I've talked about this a million times. I've had witnesses that are just innately terrible and do things intentionally to get themselves involved in the case when they know what they're saying isn't true. And then there's the majority of people who truly want to help. And unfortunately, even though in their heart and minds they believe what they're saying, they're wrong. And the unfortunate side effect to that is it really hurts the case, because when the witness comes off as credible, it can derail the investigation, because you have this person who you know is telling the truth in their mind, and you can tell they want to do the right thing. And because of what they're saying, it's discrediting multiple theories that appear to be the most prominent. And that's what we have going on here. Everything points to whatever happened to Tom happened the morning of the 13th. And then you have this outlier saying that they saw him on the 14th. But without anything to corroborate that, you have to accept it. I have to report it to you guys. But we also have to use common sense. And it doesn't appear that what Andy is saying is true, but we have more to cover. And as I get into the final facts of this case, you tell me if you think Andy's right about the date. So investigators continued searching for Tom, but no new leads came in for months. They sent flyers to police departments across the country and checked coroner's offices for unidentified remains matching Tom's physical description. But unfortunately, nothing turned up. That was until January 11th, 1992, when there was a major development. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Cravings aren't just about nicotine, they're about habit. The hand-to-mouth motion, oral fixation, the momentary pause. When that loop is broken, cravings spike, and fume replaces your habit with a flavored air fidget device that gives your hands and mouth something to do, distracting cravings without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. So don't just try to quit. Upgrade that habit loop. Reach for fume instead. As I just mentioned, no nicotine, no batteries, no vapor, just clean, natural flavors and a fidget-friendly design that actually feels good to use. I keep my fume in the office all the time, and honestly, half of it, I'm just using it as a fidget device. I really like the weight. I like the design. It's real wood, real metal. It matches the aesthetic of my office, which matters to me probably more than it should, but the fidget is really cool. It's got the magnets. Right? It's also got the twist. I got to make sure I keep it away from the mic when I'm recording, or that can become a problem. I also really like the flavor as well. My personal favorite is orange vanilla. That's what I've been using almost since day one. But they also have flavors like crisp mint, raspberry. There's a bunch on their website, so I'm sure they have something that will fit your preference. And we all know how breaking a bad habit usually goes. first week or so, you're good. You're like, I got this. No problem. This is easy. Then maybe by like week two or three, your brain starts negotiating with you, right? You could do this. You could do that. It's not really cheating. It's not really, it's just a compromise. You're fine. This is still, you're still making progress. And we all know where that ends up, right? You could just go back to what you were normally doing. But with Fume, it helps you replace that motion and that routine without falling back into an old pattern. And when you grab your journey pack, you'll also get a free gift just by using my code DETECTIVE. Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits. And now it's your turn. Use my code DETECTIVE to get a free gift with your journey pack. All you have to do is head over to tryfume.com. That's TRYFUM.com and use code DETECTIVE to claim your free gift today. I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic, aka Derek's favorite hose. You guys have been making fun of me, how much I like talking about it, but don't knock it till you try it. I know there's people out there who've already bought it. They've messaged me, they've reviewed it. They know what I'm talking about. And I've discussed working on my lawn, how I'm trying to use one certain hose for an area. It was too short, so I bought another pocket hose ballistic that was 75 feet. And now I got them both running. They work great. They're Vinny approved. They handle the abuse. They haven't broken down at all. And that's because they're reinforced with a liquid crystal polymer, which is also used in bulletproof vests. Something I know a little bit about, and I've literally bet my life on it. So yeah, if it's used in bulletproof vests, it's probably good enough for a garden hose. These things are super light, easy to manage, easy to store. You turn them on and it grows. You turn it off and it shrinks back down to pocket size. It also comes with a pocket pivot, which gives you total freedom of movement at the spigot with 360-degree rotation. You move, it follows. It's as easy as that. And I've talked about this before, but this isn't your old grandpa's hose. This thing has 100 patents worldwide. Yes, we're talking about a hose. Think about all the technology and science and R&D that's gone into this thing to make it what it is. And I can tell you, they took their time, they did it right, and it's paying off. The thing's great. And now for a limited time, when you purchase a new pocket hose ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle. Just text DETECTIVE to 64,000. That's DETECTIVE to 64,000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. All right, we're back. So let's talk about January 11th, 1992. That day, a man in Placer County, California, nearly 500 miles north of Burbank, came across bone fragments and personal belongings scattered across a remote wooded hillside in Sacramento Valley. The Placer County Sheriff's Office was contacted, and when investigators arrived, they documented several items at the scene, including a duffel bag, flashlight, hunting knife, bottled water, two pairs of prescription glasses, an empty prescription medication bottle, a belt, a boot, and several shirts. The remains and belongings were collected for testing, and during autopsy, investigators determined that whoever the remains belonged to had died from a gunshot wound. Further details on that wound have never been released. And as investigators examined the clothing found at the scene, they noticed something important. Some of the items had a motorcycle emblem on them, but none of the items told the investigators who the victim could be. They set out to find their identity and were eventually led to Tom Roche. Everything found in Placer County sounded like it belonged to Tom, so investigators contacted the Burbank police to share their theory. Barbara was eventually brought in and asked to review the belongings that were located in Placer County, and she immediately recognized the shirts and one pair of eyeglass frames as Tom's. She went on to say that she had a feeling the remains found alongside those items belonged to Tom as well, but investigators would need to conduct DNA testing to know for sure. And the process ended up taking a while because investigators had to obtain DNA samples from Tom's siblings who were still living on the East Coast. And this proved to be difficult, but eventually they got it done. In January of 1994, 2 years after the remains were found, authorities officially confirmed that they belonged to Tom Roche. When they announced the update, they also shared that Tom had died from a gunshot wound. However, they were quick to point out that they weren't sure how Tom sustained that wound. They didn't know if he had been murdered or if something else had happened, so his manner of death was undetermined. And I have to be honest with you guys, I don't agree with this at all. If this was the only thing you knew about Tom Roche, one day he was there and the next day he was gone and you found him like this and there's no letter or anything else, okay, maybe there was something going on and Tom decided to take his own life. But what would you expect to find? The gun. The gun that he shot himself with. Not there. So now you have to believe that someone came across Tom's body and decided to not report anything, but take the gun. A gun which could be connected to a murder. This person wouldn't know. Seems like a pretty stupid risk to take. I don't see someone doing that. And then when you add every other layer to the story, that has to be part of the decision-making process by the pathologist and the police department. You have a guy who clearly left abruptly, had no reason to do so, had a new job he was starting for more money, had a loving girlfriend, had everything going for him. Leaves the house in a way that he would not do. Then you have an eyewitness who comes forward and says that they saw your victim with an unidentified male hours before they disappear. And then the final nail in the coffin, you have someone write a letter returning Tom's personal belongings, saying that they killed him and allegedly would be found in the mountains. That to me would be significant enough to label this a homicide. But you tell me what you guys think. So after Tom was identified in 1994, his case went cold. Media coverage stopped and there were no public updates from law enforcement. They never identified the person who wrote the letter or how Tom sustained the gunshot wound. And Barbara really struggled after Tom's disappearance and death. She eventually moved back to Rhode Island to be closer to her family, but as I mentioned at the top of the show, she sadly passed away in January of 2010 at the age of 49, never learning what happened to Tom or who might have been responsible for his death. Today, Tom's case remains unsolved and there doesn't appear to be anyone actively pushing for answers. But Tom still has siblings who are alive and they have now spent more than 34 years without knowing what happened to their brother. That's 34 years too long. Let's not let it get to 35. All right, so let's dive into this perspective. And first off, I want to say this is a homicide. At the end, when I give my recap, my call to action, I'm going to report that his manner of death is still undetermined. It's a homicide. This man was murdered. That should be changed tomorrow. But now I want to transition and talk about this letter and talk about the potential profile for the suspect we're looking for. And I want to focus on the writer of this letter because I believe this is Tom's killer. As I said in the episode, I think most of the information in here is probably accurate. And this was done to try to, I guess, clear their own conscience, but also give Tom's family some answers. And this is probably someone who's not in the right state of mind because anybody who's intelligent and doesn't want to be caught wouldn't take this risk. But this person did. So let's talk about what's in the letter as if it's true and see what we can dissect from it. So first off, he refers to Tom as Tom Roche. That to me suggests a lack of familiarity. This was not a friend, not someone who was close to him. This is probably a stranger who was referring to him by his full name. You wouldn't do that with a normal friend. Secondly, he talks about going to jail. I almost lost my mind, never again. So this appears to be someone who may have spent some time in prison or jail. That's a pretty big pool, but it's still something that narrows it down a little bit. On top of that, he mentions that he was a Vietnam veteran, and we know that the Vietnam War happened between 1955 and 1975, and this letter was written in 1991, which means that it's been anywhere between 36 years and 16 years since they were in the Vietnam War, right? They could have been at the beginning or at the end, we don't know. And if they entered, whether they were 18 or older, that puts them in an age range between 34 and 54 years old. So far we have a person who is not a friend of Tom. They are a person who may have spent some time in prison and are between the ages of 34 and 54 years old, depending on when they entered the war and how old they were when they went to war. The next thing we have is that the writer said they met Tom at a strip club. And I don't know if I mentioned this in the episode, but it was known by people close to Tom that he did like the strip clubs. So that also appears to be accurate. And I do wonder if anybody saw Tom with someone in the strip club, or if someone else had been approached by this person prior to Tom. Was Tom his first target? Were there other attempts where someone came up during that period of time and said, hey, we're friends, I have something you might like, can we meet outside of here? That would be someone you'd want to talk to, because maybe they also saw what this person was driving. Maybe they got a plate. Who knows? I would like to think that law enforcement has already done this, but I'm throwing it out there just in case. Then we have the quote, I figured LA would be a good place. That could be taken multiple ways. Are they from LA, or are they an outsider, a transient just passing through, and they thought that California would be a good location? I don't know. I tend to believe that this person planned this out, and maybe they were from a different part of the country and chose California because of the reasons they mentioned, but also because they could get in, get out, and then disappear. And so that's what we have for the letter. But then we transition to the eyewitness testimony at Tom's complex, and we have an unidentified white male with a pickup truck. And I wanted more details about the pickup truck. I couldn't find them, but obviously law enforcement would have those. And so that gives us not a detailed profile about our suspect, but it gives us something. And that's better than nothing. We know that this person, if they're telling the truth, is, like I said, a white male between 34 and 54 years old at the time of the incident, right? In 1991, they'd be much older right now, more than likely deceased. That's the unfortunate thing about this story. Probably a Vietnam veteran, somebody who may have spent some time in prison and is from a different part of the country and may have spent some time traveling around in this truck to the local strip clubs before eventually choosing Tom. And so what do I think happened to Tom? I think the evidence paints a pretty clear picture. Tom met this person at a strip club, maybe a day before, a couple days before, and there was a planned meetup. I don't know if it was over motorcycle parts or something else that maybe Tom didn't want Barbara to know about. We may never know. But for whatever reason, he agreed to meet this person and gave them his address. And so they meet there, and this person's able to lure Tom outside the house. They go over to the pickup truck, and what I believe happened is at that point, this person pulls a gun on Tom and says, don't make a noise, don't run, don't fight, or I'm going to shoot you. Come with me. We're going to go somewhere. I want to get some money from you, whatever he said to get him in the truck. But he says, listen, as long as you don't put up a fight, nobody gets hurt. And Tom, who is a big guy and could have fought back, he's 6'2", 210 pounds. He's faced with a situation where even if the suspect is smaller, there's the ultimate equalizer. The other guy has a gun and he doesn't. And so reluctantly, he gets in the truck. And then shortly after driving away, I believe he's shot and killed. And the house even substantiates this more. Everything that was done there is suggestive that Tom didn't plan on leaving. Whatever happened, happened abruptly. He was planning on coming back into the apartment after speaking with this individual and carrying out whatever transaction they were going to carry out. You had the battery on the counter. You had the sports page unread. You had the answering machine still unplugged, which was only done when he was home. And you had the door unlocked. That is someone who left not planning to. So the writing's on the wall here. What happened? The question is, how did it happen? How did this person get away with it after all these years? And can we still identify them, even if they're no longer with us? And I think there's hope. I had said at the top of the show, science and technology today has decreased the ability to get away with crime. And just because this crime occurred in 1991, it doesn't mean we can't apply what we have today to this case. And so I want to end this episode by talking about what was found on this mountainside. There were items that were identified by Barbara as belonging to Tom. But then there were items that, as far as I know, were not. You have the duffel bag, the flashlight, the hunting knife, the bottle of water, the second pair of prescription glasses, the prescription bottle, a belt, shoes. How many of them weren't identified by Barbara? Were there any items that she was sure did not belong to Tom? You know, in some of those pictures that you've seen in this episode, there appeared to be that hunting knife. There also appeared to be some type of rope. Could these items have belonged to the killer? Were they tested for DNA? I don't have those answers, but the people who investigated this case do. And if that hasn't been done, but the evidence has been preserved correctly, it can still be done today. So the first thing I want to say is anybody who's currently in charge of this case, I have a feeling they're going to see it. And so you know what you have in your evidence locker. If you have this evidence and it's believed that it may have belonged to the killer, I am volunteering to pay for whatever you need to have those items tested. We also have accessibility to certain labs that could assist and facilitate with the lab process to make sure that you maintain a chain of custody, and we can expedite the process to try to get it done as soon as possible. Reach out. I'm available. I'm not hard to find. But I'm not going to rely on them reaching out to me. As we know, that doesn't normally happen, but hey, wishful thinking, right? We also have to rely on ourselves, the public, right? I've given you a profile of this person. It's not a lot. It's something. I'm really hoping that there's someone out there who may have encountered this person, may have even been a potential target of this person, but by the grace of God, avoided it. Maybe it's a family member or a friend of the suspect. If this is the guy we're looking for, the same guy who wrote this letter, I know he said his guilt would subside, but maybe in his last years, if he's no longer with us, he decided to confide in someone and let them know what he had done. For some reason, that person didn't come forward. Maybe they see this episode. Maybe they decide, based on what I've said tonight, the fact that Tom still has family members alive and out there and wondering what happened to him, they do the right thing and finally come forward, not only for Tom, but for his family. Listen, it's a long shot. I know that. I'm not a delusional optimist, but I do believe that good people do good things, and it's never too late. And I'm hoping something here tonight resonates with one of the people that I've described, and they come forward and finally share the information that they have. So just to recap, 36-year-old Tom Roche was last seen on the morning of September 13th, 1991, outside his apartment complex in Burbank, California, speaking with an unidentified man near a pickup truck. Months later, his remains were found nearly 500 miles away in a remote area of Placer County. Tom died from a gunshot wound, but more than 34 years later, investigators still do not know his manner of death or whether the mysterious letter sent to his family was real. If you have any information about this case, you're asked to call the Placer County Sheriff's Office at 530-886-5375. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Tom. I'm thinking about you guys. I know it's been a long time. I don't want to see this get to 35 years. And there is a strong possibility that his killer is no longer alive. But that doesn't make it any less important. We need to identify this person. We need to put their name out there. We need to give Tom the justice he deserves. The only silver lining in all of this is that we know Tom has been reunited with Barbara and they're together in this. And they're fighting for us as well. They're rooting for us. They want us to find this person. They want us to publicly name him and give the answers to not only everybody who's been wondering, but most importantly, Tom's family. I really hope that happens sooner than later. I'm willing to do whatever I can to make that happen. And I'm hoping law enforcement takes me up on my offer. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1-3 or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.